worthwhile material to have enough in history scattered and kind of pervasive and mathematical in our own day.
Representative for Alaska Airlines. It's a pleasure for me to be able to present this multi-screen slide presentation. Essentially, the presentation is put together for the 50th or 10th anniversary of Alaska Airlines merger with Toyota Airlines and other purposes. So we'll look to see some news with Nicholas, Chair Freeman, and President Hill Smith. Cosgrove. He's with the corporation something, ANPI or something like that, I'm not sure. But without much further ado, if we can get these back lights put out and we'll open the drapes, we'll have it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're going to go now. Are you ready up there in the booth?
Walter can. He couldn't run.
But now I don't care.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
be okay.
Take a ride up. I got a couple of miners I'm gonna follow to the foot of the So we take off and he poured these two miners aboard, two cases of whiskey and three loaves of bread, and that was about it. And put this walker down in this takes this thing and slides just like pulls her off and puts it into his mouth where he put down between the teeth. I'm sorry that they didn't have Pampers in those days, really. You would hear this Davis scream, and the sound of the motor just echoed back and forth between the mountains. In fact, the Alaskan steamship pilots use echo navigation. They blow the whistle and time the sound from one side to the other to see if they're in the middle of the channel. I don't know whether you folks have ever heard that before, but that's true. My father being an old pilot. But anyway, Shell, if you had to do it today, he'd file his flight plan and ask for clearance to climb to 20 feet. And he would level out at 20 feet, and then he would arrive in Sitka and request clearance to descend. There were several fishing boat skippers, and there's one little seagull that sat on a piling out there on the Navy dock across the harbor, which was on the channel, was only 200 yards across Sitka. And every time that seagull would hear this Vega coming, he'd put his head right underneath his wing. I mean, the hell of that noise. And several fishing boat skippers, they said, had cardiac arrest because Shell was just up and over. But he would, sometimes he said, 20 feet was a little too high, he was not pressurized, so he would put her down and skip to make sure that he was, have his reference point on the water. That's not, Bob Ellis isn't here, but he'll verify that. Somebody else here knows that's the way Shell used to find it. But they taught us an awful lot, and when he came up here, the Navy was strictly regulation, and we call it the United States Navy, stateside, outside, and the Alaska Navy. And when we came up here, we threw the book away. Because we landed downwind, we landed crosswind, we landed any damn way we could get down in one lump. And it was very interesting, and I wouldn't trade those experiences for the world, but I repeat, we learned an awful lot from the bush pilots. I mean, about Alaskan flying. One interesting trip I had, we call it interesting. We received a mayday from Soapstone Point Lighthouse, which is the south entrance to Icy Straits, about 20 miles west of Brady Glacier and Mount Fairweather, if you know where that is. And it was, remember the date, December the 8th, 1938. And one of the lighthouse keepers had had a ruptured appendix. The Icy Straits was frozen and solid. And there was a pretty heavy groundswell running, and this was a Pinnacle Lighthouse. I don't know whether it's still there or not. Soapstone Point. Does anybody know? Anyway, they had about an 18-foot boat. They hung on Davis. And we told them to get the victim into the ready to put into the boat, and we would attempt to get there, but was there any open water? And they said, yes, there was open water, but it was full of pan ice, which is about 12 inches thick. Well, we found this one break in the ice with the groundswell, and getting down was not so spooky. We only made about half a dozen holes in the hull. And I got the man on the boat and put him aboard and strapped him into a cot on this PPY-3. And thank God for those, that high wing and those engines, because then trying to take off into this, we only had one way to go in this very narrow break between the solid ice at sea and the solid ice on Icy Straits. And we broke every rule in the book as far as exceeding maximum manifold pressure and everything else, but we would just about break off and then a breaker go over. And ice, and you hear this crash, bang, and everything in the airplane was flying around. And I didn't know whether I had any buttons left on the seat or not that I was sitting on, but we finally got the bird in the air, and we sent a wire. Lieutenant Commander Dick Allen was our skipper at that time, and Lieutenant Ekstrom was the exec. And does that mean my time's up? And we sent a wire that have a hole in the hull, hit ice, must land or get on ramp immediately. So they cleared the ramp, and it was just a cement ramp. And the Russian church used to be right in the middle of the main drag on Sitka, right across from the Moose's Hall. And I normally didn't come in that way, but and I had never really put a P2Y3 into a steep slip. That steep a slip before, but I came in right down the main drag and landed in that channel, and we slid right up out of the water onto the cement ramp, and the good Lord made the landing, believe me, because the airplane sucked the water. They were stuffing mattresses in the holes on takeoff, and on the landing I said, restuff it, and they did, and popped the mattresses out, and she did suck in the water, but as soon as we slid up on the cement, I wasn't that hot, but the good Lord was, and he just put her right up there, and she just drained out, and the fellow that was, they took across the channel, wished to hell he'd stayed at Soapstone Point, I'm sure of that. But anyway, that was an interesting trip. And I didn't time myself when I started. We were always air conditioned. There was a PTY-3, and the PM-1 was open cockpit entirely. The PTY-3 was a clutch job. The cockpit was closed in, but the engineer sat out in the breeze, held on the goggles. And we always had, typical me, we always had the coffee pot going in the big boat. And the coffee pot was, the pot itself was secured to a little pantry table made out of aluminum. It was screwed into that. And it was parking full bore, and we had a little turbulence. And it threw the lid up, and the entire guts of the coffee pot flew up. And the coffee hit the bulkhead on the starboard side. It just ribs and skin. It's all PTY had. There's no insulation, no anything, no heating or anything. And that coffee got halfway down the side of the aircraft and with brown ice. That was the kind of air conditioning we had. All officers had to qualify for machine guns, and we had the Norden bomb sight in those days. I guess, I don't know whether they still do or not. But we would wear helmet and goggles and a shiny face mask first, and then put on your helmet and goggles. You just have a nose, hole, and eyes. Because it's sleep. And then one plane to a sleeve, and we had a bow gun, two waist guns. And we opened those, all those hatches open. And with what you had on even then, it was kind of chilly. And interesting thing about the machine guns, which was part of our deal, we'd keep the machine gun housed, and they were on a swivel ratchet, and we'd never take it up into the cold air until you were just about on target. And we'd bring the machine gun up, and the officer shot from the bow gun, and the mechs and the radio operator shot from the waist gun back aft. And they were all on the same deal. You didn't put your gun into the weather or into the breeze until you were on target. And you'd get three bursts out and she'd freeze. This is with light oil. So we decided, well, we'll put some glycerin in this oil. So we cut it 50-50, and we got about six rounds out. So then we said, the heck with that, we'll put in a straight glycerin. And that was the answer. Last resort would have been put in our White Horse Scotch, and we didn't want to do that. So, these planes had no de-icing equipment whatsoever, and Ensign McGee, on takeoff, when we had a little chop, you'd get rime ice on the windshield before you got on the step, and before the window froze on the port sideways. I would open the window, and you had on long gauntlet gloves, and I'd taken a pancake turn and put a broom handle on it and my spatula, and I'd just put her out there and get the my side clear, and the co-pilot was just had his own instruments. But that was our only de-icing equipment. Because they were about to survey these aircraft, they said, but they never did. And so they didn't want to spend $1,500 to put boots and de-icing equipment on. We didn't even have wing covers, no hanger. We'd have a foot of snow on the wings, and the skipper would say, okay, we're in condition, Baker, and let's get them aloft. And in 2 hours, after cooking the engine, draining the oil, heating the oil, and cooking the engines through these Coleman stoves and canvas chutes, and we tried bungee starters, put it on a cap, and that's the only way we could do it. Inertia starters and shotguns wouldn't do it, but it worked. And you'd get them all in the air within 2 hours. But you never knew whether you're going to be right wing heavy or left wing heavy, because you get the snow off, but you couldn't get that ice that was on top. And these are fabric wings in those days. The hull was aluminum, but the wings were fabric. We had no ready room, and they're talking about cold weather effects on personnel, aircraft, and machine guns. The machine gun I just explained. The aircraft took an awful beating, but we kept patching them up, and you learn to be a good thief. You can't find it, and they wouldn't ship it, you steal it. Or you borrow it, we put it that way. So, we didn't have thermal underwear in those days. So we would put on long johns with a full drop bottom. And this is all in the BOQ. Then you got to walk down the ramp about 100 yards from there. But you put on long johns and heavy wool breeches, a sweatshirt, a heavy wool shirt, a flight jacket, and then you put on a fur-lined flying suit that was bear fur, about 3 to 4 inches thick, and then fur-lined boots, and then these gauntlets. And then you put on a parachute harness, and then you put on a Mae West over that. And it looked like you're on Apollo 1. I mean, you just waddled. And the mech has, then you had to climb a ladder to get into the cockpit. And on a morning takeoff, this is the effect on personnel. Ensign McGee would just get about to the top step, and by the time you get all this gear on, you're soaking wet because you do it in the heat of BOQ. And you hit the top step, and then Mother Nature calls. And then you've got to scrub the mission and rush back to BOQ, zip, 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 zip. And then by the time you get dressed again, you're completely exhausted. So that's the way we would take off. However, it saved the catastrophe. There's a gentleman in Sitka by the name of Pete Kostomitnov. I don't know whether he was a Russian, whether I pronounced that correctly or not. And he spoke very Russian. Sitka was a Russian town. And the natives of Sitka, or the residents, I would say, the permanent residents, they took a dim view of these outsiders coming in, you know, until they found out that we were going to be permanent residents, and then they adopted us. And the Alaskan people are the most hospitable people in the whole world that I have run into, and number two is Australia, and I've flown around the world for years. But once we were permanent residents, they adopted us, invited us to open houses ashore on the other side. And they, we had an open house to BOQ, and Pete Kostomitnov spoke broken English, but very good Russian. And this is, I'm dating myself, but at that time they had the BOQ boasted a little portable Victrola, which you cranked with a handle, and you had to start it with your finger to get the turntable going, but you could start it either way. And at that time a song came out. He said, don't you have any Russian records? He said, oh yeah, we got one, Pete. And the old Sal song, which is just snorts and barks and everything else. And so we started the turntable backward and started the needle from the inside, and it worked out. And I said, Pete, that's real Russian. And he said, yeah, that's good. Now, that's good Russian. And we played the whole record. And it could have been Chinese, and he would have said it was Russian because he was feeling no pain, nor was anyone else. But anyway, they adopted this, and they couldn't have been more hospitable once you became a resident. If you were a tourist, get lost. Check me on the time, Ted. We went through Gatineau Channel one time with this six-plane squadron, P-2Y-3, single-plane deployment. And we were heading back for Sitka. We're coming down from Kodiak. And I know everybody knows what a Willowaw is, and we happened to hit the Gatineau Channel just as a Willowaw came down. And when I looked down, I saw the water was white spray was going 50 and 100 feet in the air, and I was wondering what in the heck that was, you know. And I very shortly found out, because these birds were completely uncontrollable. You'll have the yoke all the way forward, and you'd be going standing on your tail, and then all of a sudden she'd dive, and you pull back on the yoke. We didn't torse it because you'd break it in two. And you'd have it all the way back, and she started diving. So we got through gas in the channel, and once again, to make a long story short, it cracked the tails on all six airplanes. We didn't know that till we got to Sitka. It was a good thing. And we didn't wear chutes, but we had these chute harnesses, and we used the quick attachable chest harness, which was underneath your seat. Everybody put on that, snap, snap. And you hope that you hit the snaps when you put it on. Anyway, there's one Norwegian fisherman, speaking of Moose's Hall. He was a newcomer, and it was salmon season. This was summertime, and people love to do the shottish and pokers up there. I don't know why. It's a Russian town. And it was Saturday night, and it's a white frame building, and it was just oil cannon. I mean, everybody was having a ball. And this Norwegian came in with his salmon boat, and he said, "What in the hell is going on?" And they said, "They're holding a moose's ball." And he said, "Well, I better let the critter go before he kicks the place down." Anyway, I told you, anybody under 18, leave. But it had its lighter moments, too. They were just one girl short for the bachelor officers in the squadron, which kept it interesting. It was sort of a rotation deal, a little competition. And it was sort of a game to cut somebody's throat. And 4 months is a long time, you know. You can get cabin fever quickly. But anyway, this one young lady lived out on an island off of Sitka in the ocean. Very attractive young girl. Wonderful family. Her father was a fisherman. Her mother was a typical pioneer Alaskan woman of what I call a handsome, beautiful woman. I mean, she was rugged and just as nice. She used to knit me socks. Anyway, on Friday when we were about to secure, with the CO's permission, I would take my airplane and tool out over this island, which is about 10 miles from Sitka, and make a flyby right down by the front porch. And they'd come out in the front porch, and you come by on the second pass, and you had a note wrapped up in a rag, pick you up in the whaleboat at 1800. And I'd go back and land, and take the whaleboat out, and pick up my date. She'd come into Sitka, and RON with a school teacher friend, and that was a Saturday night dance. But anyway, I'll finish this up now. It's a few of the highlights, due to time, and I'm surprised I can last this long. It's your misfortune. I've had a strep throat, but anyway, I fell in love in Alaska in 1930. That was my first visit up here. And she's a beautiful, but we all know, a temperamental lady. And when I joined Pan American, they tattooed across your forehead or your brain that aviation, and I quote this, "Aviation is not inherently dangerous, but to an even greater degree than the sea." And I come from the third generation of a seafaring family. "It is entirely unforgiving of any carelessness, incompetence, or neglect," unquote. Now, my idea of Alaska is just, I believe this is true because I know the sea well. And it applies to the sea, but you just eliminate sea from that and put in Alaska, and that tells it all right there about flying in Alaska. And another favorite expression of mine that I learned up here in Alaska years ago, in Alaska, there are no strangers. There are just friends I haven't yet met. Over and out, 10-4, and thank you. Did I go over, Ted?
Yeah, a little bit. Please.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I could bore you for a week. I got my coffee.